Welcome to Wise Counsel, a podcast interview series sponsored by MentalHelp.net, covering topics in mental health, wellness, and psychotherapy. My name is Dr. David Van Nuys. I'm a clinical psychologist and your host. On today's show, we'll be talking about a new theory of why people commit suicide with Dr. Thomas Joyner. Thomas Joyner, Ph.D., grew up in Georgia, went to college at Princeton, and received his Ph.D. in clinical psychology from the University of Texas at Austin. He is Distinguished Research Professor and the Bright Burton Professor in the Department of Psychology at Florida State University. Dr. Joyner's work is on the psychology, neurobiology, and treatment of suicidal behavior and related conditions. Author of over 385 peer-reviewed publications, Dr. Joyner was recently awarded the Guggenheim Fellowship and the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Residency Fellowship. He was elected Fellow of the American Psychological Association and received the Young Investigator Award from the National Alliance for Research on Schizophrenia and Depression, the Schacow Award for Early Career Achievement from the Division of Clinical Psychology of the American Psychological Association, the Schneidman Award for Excellence in Suicide Research from the American Association of Suicidology, and the Award for Distinguished Scientific Early Career Contributions from the American Psychological Association, as well as research grants from the National Institute of Mental Health and various foundations. He's editor of a number of publications, and he's the author of Why People Die by Suicide, as well as a book that's currently in press, Myths and Understandings About Suicidal Behavior. Among his many appearances, he's been on the Dr. Phil Show twice. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Thomas Joyner, welcome to Wise Counsel.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, I recently discovered your work as a result of a flyer I received in the mail announcing the upcoming 42nd annual conference of the American Association of Suicidology. That's a mouthful. At which you'll be giving a work.
That's right. Yep. It's coming up in April in San Francisco.
Exactly. So if anyone listening would like to attend, it is a 3-day conference in San Francisco, and it will be held April 15 through April 18th. And we'll put a link to it on our website. So if anybody wants more information, they can find it there. At any rate, as I read the blurb about you and your workshop, and also found other information about you on the internet, I quickly saw that you're a major player in this field, and I was eager to interview you.
Well, I'm happy to be with you. Looking forward to it.
Well, right after receiving my own PhD back in 1970, I was in charge of training volunteers for a suicide hotline in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I seem to recall that the authority at that time was Dr. Edward Schneidman, and I blush to say I've not kept up with the field. I'm sure that quite a bit has been learned since that time.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Dr. Schneidman. I spoke to him on the phone just a couple days ago. He's 90 years old, but still writing away and still an influential figure in suicide research. But yeah, to answer your question, definitely. There have been several exciting advances over the past couple, three decades.
Well, let's start off with my asking you how you came to be involved in the study of suicide.
There are two sort of sources to my professional work, one personal, one professional. The professional source was that I started out as a graduate student and then as a young professor as a clinician and as a scientist studying major depressive disorder, and did a lot of research on that condition and on some of the psychological risk factors for it. But as you may know, one of the main complications of that condition is suicidal ideation and behavior, and in a fair proportion of cases, death by suicide. And it just struck me how the worst possible complication of the condition was really getting the least amount of research attention. And so that kind of pushed me toward the study of suicide in particular. I'd already been doing that work when I lost my dad to suicide in 1990. That's the personal source. And that certainly added a great sense of urgency to the research work.
Yes, you've written a book titled Why People Die by Suicide, and it begins with a very personal and moving account of losing your father to suicide. Do I recall correctly that happened while you were still in graduate school?
Right. I think I was in my third year of graduate school.
Wow. Can you say a little bit about what the impact of that was on you? I mean, I just imagine how, I would think it might have derailed a person from their graduate studies and so on to have something of that magnitude happen.
Well, it was very agonizing, very, very shocking, and the loss, it's so profound that it's difficult to put into words. As for its, impact on, my interest in the field and my work as a budding psychologist, I think what you say is really true, is that it could have a negative effect, derail someone. But it really had the opposite effect on me. It really created a resolve to fight the condition or the phenomenon that took my dad away. It really has become a point of honor that the thing that took my dad away is, in a sense, going to pay. And the way that I'm going to try to make it pay is to reduce and eliminate it. And I feel that the only way to do that is through rigorous scientific research.
Well, that's certainly making the best of a very difficult situation. Now, suicide is a large problem in this country and around the world, and there are statistics that you cite in your book. I don't know if you have any of those at hand or on the top of your mind. Can you give us any of the kind of outstanding statistics in regard to suicide?
Well, I think a couple are incredibly important is that every year in the United States, we lose well over 30,000 people to death by suicide year in and year out. And that's just in the United States alone. And what that boils down to in terms of daily deaths in the U.S. is over 80 deaths per day.
Wow.
So every single day, today, tomorrow, the next day, 80 or more Americans, we're going to lose them to death by suicide. And when you focus out just not on the U.S., but on the world as a whole, we're talking about a million people who die by suicide every year, year in and year out. It's a massive public health problem, and it's a massive international killer.
Okay. Well, in your book, you advance a new theory of suicide, which you say replaced a previous theory that's about 15 years old. Well, what was that old theory?
Well, I think it's really a family of previous theories, a collection of them, if you will. And we mentioned Dr. Schneidman earlier. He's had some influential theorizing about psychological pain being the key source to suicidal behavior. And there were other theorists, too, who are very important and who've influenced me quite a lot. I'd point to Dr. Beck in Philadelphia as someone. And Dr. Beck and his team have focused on the concept of hopelessness as a very important trigger for suicidal behavior. And while I think Dr. Schneidman and Dr. Beck both were onto something very important, I also think that they weren't specific enough. Concepts like psychological pain and hopelessness are pretty general. And so part of my work has been to get very specific about exactly what it is that people are in pain about. And as I imagine we'll discuss, what I think that boils down to is a sense of being a burden on other people and also the sense of loneliness and alienation and isolation. And so that's my answer about getting more specific and precise about just what it is people are in pain about or hopeless about. The other problem I had with previous theorists is that all of them have neglected what I think is a key precondition. And it's a sense of fearlessness about pain and injury and death. You know, if you think about it, we're self-preserving creatures. We're wired that way. And we're also wired to shy away, to be afraid of things that hurt us and injure us and kill us. And so to be able to enact death by suicide, it's actually a very fearsome and daunting prospect. And to be able to do it requires a certain kind of fearlessness. And this fearlessness had been completely, really pretty much completely neglected in the previous suicide literature.
Well, that sort of flies in the face of the common perception that, or the common opinion that suicide is an act of cowardice.
Indeed, and I think that's a common misconception of what's involved in suicidal behavior. To do something as daunting and as fearsome as that, it does require a kind of fearlessness. Now, by no means do I want to promote a sense of suicide as being somehow glorious or romantic or poetic. On the contrary, it's horrible and agonizing. The fact remains, to enact something this horrible and agonizing does require a kind of fearlessness, and that's one of the touchstones of the new theory of suicidal behavior that I've developed.
Well, take us through that new theory a bit more, if you will. Maybe you can tell us how it emerged from your own clinical work or research, and say a little bit more about each of the kind of main pillars of the theory.
Sure. There are three main pillars, and I've already prefaced each of the three. Let me just name them, and then I'll go into each of them specifically.
Right.
The three are perceived burdensomeness. The second one is isolation, loneliness, alienation, that kind of thing. And then the third pillar is that sense of fearlessness that I was referring to. And the way the theory is put together, the idea is that if somebody feels like they're a burden on the people they love, in other words, they have in their heads the mental calculation, my death will be worth more than my life to people that I care about. If they think that's true, even though it's rarely true, if they believe it to be true, the idea is that that's an important precursor to the desire for death. But there's another piece of that puzzle, and it's the loneliness, the alienation. The theory claims that if people feel the sense of burdensomeness together with the sense of alienation, and if they feel that long enough and severely enough, they'll develop a desire for death. This desire for death is actually a fairly common phenomenon. It certainly is common on inpatient psychiatry, where a lot of patients have major depressive disorder or bipolar disorder. Very common aspect of those conditions is to have ideas about suicide, desires for suicide, and yet a striking fact is that luckily, relatively few of the people who have ideas about suicide attempt suicide, much less die by suicide. And that's where the fearlessness piece comes in, the third pillar. The idea is that of all the people who desire suicide, it's only a very small proportion who have developed the wherewithal to enact suicide, the sense of fearlessness about injury, pain, and death. You can kind of think of the theory as a perfect storm kind of theory where three things have to come together simultaneously. And those three things, again, are perceived burdensomeness, a sense of isolation, and this characteristic of fearlessness.
Okay, you have a chapter on what we know and what we don't know about why people commit suicide. So let's look at those two pieces. What is it that we know?
Well, there are a lot of facts about it. There are facts, for instance, just as we were talking about that, although in the U.S., 80 people die every day. That sounds like a lot, and indeed it is a lot. It's 80 too many, in my view. That actually is a kind of a low figure when you compare it to some other causes of death, like heart disease, for instance. We lose over 2,000 Americans every day to heart disease. And so suicide's a relatively rare form of death, and so that's something that we know to be a fact. We know that gender is associated with suicide in very interesting ways, namely that men are far more likely to die by suicide than women, whereas women are more likely to attempt suicide but survive. We know that there's an association with ethnicity. In the U.S., Caucasian people are far more at risk than all other ethnicities except Native American people, who have similarly high risk rates as Caucasian people. And there's several other facts like that that have been established. And what my work is partly trying to do is to develop a new explanation of suicidal behavior that can shed some new light on these old facts.
What is it that we don't know? Where are the big gaping holes in our knowledge?
Well, I mean, the holy grail, so to speak, is of 100% prediction, risk assessment protocols that will allow 100% prediction. We're nowhere near that. Similarly, we're nowhere near treatments and prevention programs that are 100% protective. So those are some crucial things where our knowledge base is coming up short and where we need to do a lot more to save lives.
Okay, what about the role of genetics? Do those play a role?
Absolutely. There's no question that there's a genetic component. The best estimates of how much of suicidal behavior is genetic comes down along the lines of 35%, 40%, somewhere in that ballpark, which means that 60% of how things turn out have nothing to do with genetics. So it's, you know, like a lot of complex human behaviors, there's a genetic piece and there's a non-genetic piece. With suicide, it's a substantial genetic piece, but it shouldn't be overblown. It's only about 35%, maybe 40% of outcomes.
Okay, and I know that you're also interested in the role of the brain. We've been discovering so much about the brain with the neuroimaging tools that we have available today. What can you say about the role of neurobiology?
Well, it's a fascinating fact. You know, for a behavior that is as complex as suicidal behavior, you would kind of imagine that all sorts of brain regions and all sorts of kinds of neurochemicals and other neurobiological factors are implicated, but actually the best research today really pins down most of the action at the brain level in the serotonin system. And serotonin is a neurotransmitter, a neurochemical, very important for the regulation of mood and sleep and appetite. And we were just talking about the genes that are involved or the genetics are involved. We haven't really located specific genes that are candidates for risk factors, but we have honed in on a couple or a few, and the most promising, all of them, are genes that code for various aspects of the serotonin system. So we're neurobiologically, the research is on the trail of genes and other factors that influence the serotonin system.
Well, that sounds exciting. What about the role of mental disorders, for example, depression, bipolar, schizophrenia, and so on?
I think two points are crucial. The first is that there's a clear role, an absolutely essential role for mental disorders and suicidal behavior. There's a wide consensus in the field that at least 90% of suicide decedents are experiencing a mental disorder at the time of death, and you mentioned the main ones, major depressive disorder, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, another big two are borderline personality disorder, and anorexia nervosa. My view, though, is that it's actually more like 100% of suicide decedents are experiencing some form of a mental disorder at the time of their death. So that's a crucial fact. But the other crucial fact is that if you look at all the people who have mental disorders, we can just focus in on one, major depressive disorder. Of all the people who have that condition, it's crucial to remember that only about 8%, 7%, something like that, will end up dying from the condition through suicide. So the conditions are extremely important, but by themselves, they're not enough to explain suicidal behavior, because most people who have the illness don't end up dying from it via suicide.
Okay. Well, what about the role of age? I'm kind of imagining a U-shaped curve with suicide being higher among teens, say, and the aged. I don't know if that's accurate.
No, it's really not. It's more of a linear line upwards. Mm-hmm. The older you get, the more at risk you are. The it's interesting about the teens. There's definitely been a noticeable increase in the rate of suicide among youth. In fact, some of the best data suggests that over the last 25, 35 years, the rate has nearly doubled among young people. But even with that near doubling, the rates are not even close to what they are in people who are 50, 60, 70, and so forth. So it's pretty much a linear trend up the age range.
Yeah, when you were talking about, one of the main pillars of your theory was the isolation, burdensomeness, all of that, that sort of brought to mind the older population.
Yeah, I think that's one of the facts, one of the, empirical facts that we were talking about earlier, where we know this to be true, and it's one way, or one, fact that I think my theory explains in a way that's, arguably a little more persuasive than past theories. Certainly the fearlessness component fits with the age finding, the idea being that it's only with experience, practice, and age that people can get used to dangerous things, things that will hurt them or kill them. And certainly age is going to be associated with that kind of experience and previous practice.
So would there be a correlation then between people who are sort of thrill seekers, who have done a lot of sort of potentially life-threatening things, like maybe skydiving or other kinds of activities like that?
Absolutely, it's kind of complicated how it works. I mean, certainly those kinds of behaviors will instill the fearlessness component that I'm talking about, but it's really important to remember that that's only one piece of the puzzle, and you got to have the other two pieces mm-hmm. as well. So yes, those kinds of behaviors do increase one aspect of the model, but they might not increase the other two, and thus may not increase the outcome of death by suicide. But you see this in a lot of different populations. Right now, a very worrisome and timely topic is death by suicide in the military. And certainly, those men and women in combat have plenty of opportunity to witness or experience themselves things that are, have the potential to get them, used to pain, injury, and death. And that's one possible factor that's, potentially an explanation for why we're seeing a real rash of suicides in the military. You see it in physicians, too. Physicians have among the highest rates of suicide among the professions. And I think that's largely because day in and day out, their work gets them used to injury and pain and violence and indeed death. And so if a physician develops the desire for suicide, he or she is uniquely equipped to enact it.
Yes. Well, what are the signs that someone is at risk to commit suicide?
This is just a crucial question because it's so important for public health. It's a simple message, but it's one that's very often overlooked. The clearest signs are the most obvious ones, things like people are saying that they intend to kill themselves. People are writing notes about their intentions to kill themselves. People are giving away prized possessions, in a kind of inexplicable fashion. These are extremely obvious things, but you'd be surprised, or perhaps you wouldn't, but anyway, they are overlooked all the time. So in terms of warning signs, those are really crucial ones to pay attention to. Some other important ones are things like a very dramatic change in behavior or mood for the worse. Also, signs having to do with kind of agitated, sleepless kinds of states of mind. When people are having bad insomnia combined with a kind of agitation where they can't get comfortable in their own skin, that's kind of an important danger sign as well.
Now, you suggested that we don't have any sort of 100% therapeutic interventions, but what sorts of interventions do you recommend?
Well, I think the one of the simpler ways to come at the question is to go back to our discussion of mental disorders, and they certainly do seem to spur the vast majority, if not all, of suicidal behavior. Therefore, it stands to reason that if those underlying conditions are aggressively treated, that should, one would think, one would hope, reduce the outcome of suicide. And so, you know, just very good, modern, scientifically supported treatments for conditions like major depressive disorder and bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. And in most cases, that will involve medications, especially for schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, combined with modern, kind of here and now kinds of psychotherapy. Usually those will fall under the umbrella of cognitive behavioral psychotherapies. That's kind of the leading treatment package for virtually every major mental disorder, is the combination of cognitive behavioral therapy with an appropriate medicine.
And what advice do you have for family or friends who may be dealing with someone who's feeling suicidal?
Well, the warning signs is a great place to start. Those are things to look out for and to watch out for. Another piece of advice is to patiently but very persistently counsel treatment, encourage treatment, go into one's doctor to talk about a medicine or seeing a psychologist for therapy, et cetera, et cetera. Another very important resource is the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. This is a project that's funded by the federal government, and the toll-free number associated with it is 1-800-273-TALK. 273-TALK. And the great thing about this project is that it links together about 150 crisis centers across the country, all of which are adhering to the standards developed by the project. And wherever you call in the U.S., 1-800-273-TALK will link you with a trained crisis counselor. Somebody who's in crisis themselves certainly can call that number, but so can family and friends call that number for advice and also for tips about how and where to access treatment.
Well, that's a great resource to be aware of, and I'll make sure that we put that in our notes as well. Now, closely related to my last question, how can friends and relatives support someone who has already lost someone to suicide? I know in your book, in that chapter where you talk about your father's suicide, you recount stories of how some people had very helpful things to say and other people didn't. So what counsel would you offer people in that regard?
Basically, it boils down just to acting right. You know, if somebody that you know has lost a family member all of a sudden, what's acting right? Well, it means going to the funeral. It means providing support. It means checking in on them, just as you would for anyone that has lost a loved one suddenly, whether it's a heart attack or stroke or an accident, or in this case, death by suicide. I think that trips a lot of people up. I know it did in the aftermath of my dad's death, that where people just somehow get it in their heads that this is different and scary and taboo territory. And so they back off and they ignore the family and so forth. Virtually every family member who's been through this will tell you a similar story. And that's exactly the opposite of what's needed. What's needed is just acting right, support, condolences, checking in, just like as if it were any other form of death. And I should also say, as you pointed out, that there are several people, friends, and others who did that for me and my family. But there certainly were others who failed in that regard.
Yeah, I think often people feel a kind of paralysis of fearing that they're going to say the wrong thing. And so, unfortunately, they say nothing and kind of withdraw from the situation.
Yeah, I think you probably put your finger on an important part of it. And I would just counsel people to overcome that fear and to remember that it's kind of hard to say the wrong thing if, you know, all you're saying is how sorry you are and how much you want to help out.
Yeah. Now, somewhere I saw that you're working on a book about myths and misconceptions about suicide. Are there any major misconceptions that we haven't covered here?
Well, we talked about a major one, that it's, you know, mostly the province of cowards, and how that's wrong because it actually requires a kind of fearlessness. There are a few others that we probably haven't touched on too much. You know, the book, it's coming out in about a year. It covers around 25 or 30 individual myths or misconceptions. I guess I'll just kind of pick a couple out, sort of more or less randomly. One is about suicide as anger turned toward the self.
Oh, yes. That's a kind of a psychoanalytic notion.
Yeah, definitely. And a related notion is that it's all about revenge. And my view on that is that that's not quite right. It's occasionally there are deaths by suicide that tend to have that character. But if you harken back to the three pillars of my theory, especially the one about burdensomeness, if it's right that burdensomeness is a main cause of suicidal behavior, that's really the opposite of trying to get revenge or anger. What the suicide decedent is thinking, now this is a mistaken thought, but that's what they're thinking, is that they're actually doing people a favor. They think that by removing themselves, they're helping everybody out. Now, they're tragically wrong about that, but the catch is that they don't know that they're wrong about that. They think it to be true, and it spurs their behavior. So trying to help people out is actually the opposite of trying to get revenge on them. So I think that one is an important myth. There are a few others, one having to do with treatment. I'm really concerned about the FDA and the media's treatment of antidepressant medicines, things like Prozac, Paxil, Lexapro, etc. The data are so clear that they are helpful treatments for conditions like major depressive disorder. There are occasional side effects where people do get ideas about suicide from the medicines, but in my opinion, those have been terribly overblown to the point that a lot of physicians, especially primary care physicians, are scared off of prescribing them. And I'm just very concerned that can have a kind of backfiring effect where suicides are going to increase because people are not getting the right treatments and enough of the right treatments for the underlying conditions for the for suicidal behavior.
Okay, there are a couple of specific issues I'd like to ask you about. We've mentioned the upcoming conference of the American Association of Suicidology, where you're going to be giving a workshop in San Francisco. And you're probably aware of the longstanding debate, or maybe not since you don't live in this area, in regard to putting a barrier on the Golden Gate Bridge to stop people from committing suicide. I'm not sure if the issue's been settled yet or not, but I believe there are issues of cost and aesthetics versus trying to save lives. And some people say if a person's decided to commit suicide, they'll find a way regardless. Do you have an opinion regarding a suicide barrier for the Golden Gate Bridge?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this hits on another of the myths that I cover in that book. The myth being that if somebody's prevented at one location, they'll just go to another location. You know, or if they have one means taken away from them, they'll just access some other kinds of means. In this case, if someone's prevented by a barrier or barrier at a bridge, they'll just go to another bridge, or they'll just go somewhere else and use another means. That's a myth. The evidence could not be clearer that things like bridge barriers work. When they're put up, they save lives and people, and you do not see an increase in deaths by jumping from other bridges or from accessing other kinds of means. So I could not be more in favor of bridge barriers because they've been shown, in my view, definitively to save lives. And I think it is pretty unconscionable that one was not put up at the Golden Gate, but that's changing, and that is going to happen. The issue, as you pointed out, was money and aesthetics. And, you know, for someone like me to hear that money and aesthetics are more important than saving lives, it's a moral outrage, and I'm glad that the Bridge Commission and others have come to their senses about that.
Okay, good. I'm glad I thought to ask you about that. Now, what about the issue of assisted suicide for the terminally ill? Is this an issue that you've studied?
A little bit. I'm interested in all phenomena that have suicidal elements. And assisted suicide would be one. Suicide terrorism would be another one. These are tricky things to explain theoretically, and most previous theories have just said at the beginning, I don't know about all that. I don't know about suicide terrorism. I don't know about assisted suicide. And what I've tried to do is take a different tack and say, there may be conventional suicides where we should be focusing most of our attention, but there are also suicides that are on the periphery of the conventional definition that probably also need attention. And I've tried to explain some of these phenomena with the three pillars of my theory. With regard to assisted suicide, it's an interesting fact that if you take a large group of people who are terminally ill, and then among that group, it's first of all crucial to point out that only about a third of them desire death. Even if you take a group that's all equally ill, all equally in pain, only about a third of them will desire death. And interestingly, that third is characterized by a desire to make other people better off, very akin to my theoretical concept of burdensomeness. So I think that it's a concept that can be fit into the theoretical framework. Having said that, though, the law in Oregon has worked out pretty well because they've structured it so carefully and just made it very safe in the sense of not letting people who are primarily going through a mental disorder access this procedure. And so I will say that I've been impressed with how the law has been developed and enacted in Oregon.
Okay, well, are there any other thoughts that you'd like to share with our listeners as we wrap up?
I would just remind everyone of a couple points. One is how treatable these conditions are that underlie suicidal behavior. It can take a lot of persistence in patients, but they are treatable in accessing good psychotherapy, which means modern and scientifically effective treatments, combined with medicines or just really, that's so crucial. And the other thing I would say is to have compassion for people who attempt suicide, people who die by suicide, and their family members. They need compassion. They deserve it. And if we take a compassionate view and a scientific view and put those two things together, my hope is that we'll make progress in the coming years on reducing deaths from this, massive international killer.
Wonderful. Well, Dr. Thomas Joyner, you've been very generous with your time and information, and I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Wise Counsel.
You're most welcome. I appreciate the opportunity.
I hope you found this interview with Dr. Thomas Joyner as interesting as I did. I believe him to be one of the foremost voices in suicidology today. If you're a professional looking to earn continuing education units, you might want to consider attending the American Association of Suicidology Conference in San Francisco. Once again, the dates are April 15th through the 18th, 2009. You can find complete program details on their website at www.suicidology.org. And you might also want to make note of that National Suicide Lifeline number. Once again, that's 1-800-273-TALK. You've been listening to Wise Counsel, a podcast interview series sponsored by MentalHelp.net. If you found today's show interesting, we encourage you to visit MentalHelp.net, where you can add a comment or question to this show's webpage, view other shows in this series, or simply page through the site, which is full of interesting mental health and wellness content. Access this show's page and show archive information via the podcast box on the mentalhelp.net homepage. If you like Wise Counsel, you might also like Shrink Wrap Radio, my other interview podcast series, which is available online at www.shrinkwrapradio.com, and wrap is spelled R-A-P. Until next time, this is Dr. David Van Nuys, and you've been listening to Wise Counsel.